told you that our speaker tonight is Dan Bridge. And, you know, around to that, someone that might know them. And so I don't know Dan very well at all. I'll have to say that. But I do know this, that I really appreciate when he comes into meetings and he shares his experience, faith, and hope, and also how he kind of been and started doing some service work. And I see him as a real big asset to our group. And I'm sure glad that you came, Dan. And I wish I knew you better so I could say more things and maybe say some funny things about you, but I don't know anything. So I'm just going to turn it over to you, Dan. So go ahead.
Thank you very much, Ross. Can everybody hear me, first of all? Somebody typed yes. Okay, good. Thank you very much. Hi, I'm Dan, and I am a nicotine addict. And it's really, really good to be here tonight. Thank you very much, Ross, for that introduction. If you want to get to know me better, you should have been at that one meeting we had, that one Saturday night. Sunday morning, early Sunday morning, we sat in the room and just were cracking jokes one time. We had a blast in there, and I just let everything out. Anyway, that's not like me. As I was saying, my name is Dan. I am a nicotine addict, and I am powerless over nicotine, and my life has become unmanageable because of it. And, you know, a while back, if someone could have looked into a crystal ball and said, Dan, do you know that you're going to be on June 18th, 2005, you're going to be admitting to a group of people that you are powerless and your life has become unmanageable, I would have told them you're full of crap. There's no way. Because powerlessness to me is synonymous with failure, no good,
addictive behavior.
The first time I smoked, I was 11 years old, and my cousin and I, we had built this tree fort out in the backyard, and how we built, it was in an orange tree, and how we built this tree fort, instead of having walls made out of wood, we got these old blankets that our parents had been throwing out, our mothers had been throwing out, and we hung them on the branches for the walls of this tree house. And we thought it would be cool if we could steal cigarettes from our parents and go up in the tree house, and we didn't even inhale. I mean, 11 years old, you know, sit there and you know, just sucking it into our mouths. Man, I'm so cool, man. I'm grown up now. I'm an adult, you know what I mean? And anyways, I went up there one time. Me and my cousin, we used to do this together. But one time I went up there alone, he had stolen a whole pack out of his dad's carton. Benson and Hedges lights. I still remember the brand. The Benson and Hedges menthol, should I say, light cigarettes back then. Anyways, I went up there, and how I lit the cigarette was I had a book of matches. I would light the match, light the cigarette, and then instead of waving the match out to make sure that it was out, I would just throw the match behind me without even looking at the age of 11. But what happened was I threw the match after I lit the cigarette behind me, not look, and went on the blanket. It was hanging from the branches, and it was still lit. And the blanket caught on fire. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting there, you know, thinking, I'm all cool, puffing away at the cigarette. I see the smoke come over my shoulder. I turn around, and the blanket is in flames. And the tree starts to catch fire, and I went into a panic. And I went, oh, my God. And I climbed down the tree to save my own life. I went running home, and I knew that if I didn't tell anybody that, you know, this fire was going to spread, I had to tell somebody. And I was going to get in trouble for it, but I had to tell somebody. So I told my mom, and they went back there, and we got the garden hoses, and they put it out and everything like that. And I had to tell them that, you know, we stole cigarettes and everything like that, and I got in a lot of trouble for that. Now, that was my introduction to cigarettes. It was a bad introduction. That kept me away from smoking. You know, I related, okay, smoking is bad, starts fires, blah, blah, blah. I was 11 years old. That kept me away from cigarettes for 3 years, okay? I didn't smoke, didn't want to have no desire or nothing like that. By the time I got into high school, 1974, I was 14 years old. And I'm looking around as a freshman in high school, and I notice that these, you know, jocks and everything, they're driving daddy's car, and they got the cheerleaders on their shoulder, and they're quarterback of the football team and class president and all this, real popular with the student body. And I wanted to be that so bad. I was just little old dad over here with a little punky freshman with a long hair, and I wanted to be so cool, so liked, and so popular so badly that I couldn't do that. Well, there was a group of us kids that were kind of not as popular as the rest of us, the rebels, as we called it, and they smoked cigarettes. And one day, my friend came up to me and he said, hey, man, why don't you start smoking, man? You know, it's really cool, you know? And I just wanted to be accepted and liked and blah, 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 you know, how we go through that phase. So, I started smoking, and I remember my first day of smoking. Back then, they had this gas station on the corner by our high school, and behind the gas station there was this little shed with a cigarette machine. Back in the days of cigarette machines, you had 50 cents, you dropped it in, pack of Marlboro Red came down. Every teenager under the age of 18 in that city would go to this gas station, and it was real easy. Nobody, you know, you could just buy cigarettes day after day after day, pack of pack of pack every day, and everybody was getting cigarettes from there. And I remember my first day of smoking. After school, we went to a park across the street from the high school, and there was a girl there, I'll never forget her name. Her name was Joyce Simpson, and she was flirting with me, and we were smoking cigarettes, thinking, man, we're so cool, you know, smoking cigarettes and stuff like that. Well, I wanted to impress this girl that was flirting with me, so I decided, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to chain smoke 2 cigarettes to show her how tough I am. So I lit up 1 cigarette, and I puffed that whole thing down, and I'm practicing. I'm just learning. This is my first day, just learning how to inhale cigarettes, okay? Well, I got to the first cigarette. Immediately, I whip out another one, stick it in my mouth, light that thing up, and I'm going for it, you know. I get about halfway through that cigarette, my face turned 5 shades of green. The next thing you know, I'm leaning over a trash can in the park, puking my guts up. And this did not impress Joy Simpson. She was not impressed at all. She wanted nothing to do with me after that, and she left me. Left me way alone after I threw up. She stopped flirting with me and everything. So now that was my second introduction to nicotine, and that also was a bad experience. I lost a potential girlfriend, and I embarrassed myself, and I threw up. I made myself sick. Did that stop me from smoking this time? No. this time I'm going to do it. I'm going to show you how bad I am. And I continued to smoke. And I would take my lunch money and you know, 50 cents. I would go up and buy a pack of cigarettes a day. And I'd work myself up to about a pack a day. But not all the time would I have the money for cigarettes. And at the age of 14, I started, when I didn't have money for my own cigarettes, I went over and I stole my mother's cigarettes. My mother smoked for 40 years. And my mom, you know, I would sit on the side of the house and I would smoke these cigarettes. My mom wasn't stupid. She knew that I smoked. She could smell it on me and everything, I guess. And she came up to me one day and she said, you know, she came from that era way back before the Surgeon General's warnings and all that. And she told me, you know what, Danny, if you're going to smoke, don't hide it from me. I know you smoke. Go ahead and smoke. And she started to allow me to smoke in the house in front of her. I was only 14 years old. And I said, okay. And I thought, hey, this is cool. You know, if mom says it's cool, I'm going for it, man. I am now a smoker. And I was smoking all the time, you know, just as my addiction grew from that through my teenage years, I became very dependent on nicotine emotionally, mentally, and physically over the years. And Marlboro became my friend because of my low self-esteem. If I wasn't as popular or if somebody didn't like me or they made fun of me or whatever, I could go over in this corner and me and Marlboro against the world. You know what I mean? You could sit there and flip me off, but I got my friend right here in my shirt pocket. And this is my friend now. I'm just going to go over here and I'm going to smoke. And I don't need you. I can make it with Marlboro. It's cool. So I continued to smoke and I became really addicted and I just loved my smoking and loved everything about it. It was the way it rushed through my body, the way it felt in my lungs, and the way it tasted, the way it felt in my fingers, the hand to the mouth action, the way the pack felt in my shirt pocket, everything, man. I was just really cool. While during those years, I watched a friend, an older woman. She had emphysema in my teenage years. I'll never forget. And she smoked Camel Nub filters for years and years. And she couldn't quit smoking. She used to have an oxygen tank. And she switched to mics finally. And she tried to cut down and quit, but she couldn't do it. And that left a big impression on me about cigarettes and the addiction of nicotine. But I still didn't quit. I figured that can happen to other people, it ain't gonna happen to me. Not yet. I'm still young. You know, I'm still healthy and stuff like that. But I never did forget that. That was like a first warning for me. In the early 80s, my mother, she smoked about 40 years. And in the early 80s, cigarettes went up to about $1 a pack, and my mom had a fit. She's a recovering alcoholic through AA, and she figured, you know what, if she could do this with AA, she could do it with cigarettes too. And when they went up to $1 a pack, she said, forget it, that's too much, I ain't spending that kind of money. She used a 12-step program to quit her smoking, and that was about 1983. And she just quit cold turkey, put it down, and that was it. She used a 12-step program, and she made it. She never smoked again. She made that decision, she put that decision into action, and she quit. I was amazed, because she was like a two-pack-a-day smoker, and it was just really, really amazing that she did that. And I continued to smoke, though, regardless. You know, I didn't care. I was going to smoke anyway. And I smoked all throughout the 80s, and then in the 90s, by the time that the 90s came, the California state legislators started to make it illegal, and everybody in society really started to hate smoking cigarettes, and they were really looked down upon, and they were making it illegal to smoke in restaurants and in public places and all that. And I started to have to go through the hell of being in a group of people in a restaurant. I would be the only smoker there. Everybody else was not smoking. We would eat our meal. Then we'd sit around. We'd still be talking and stuff like that. I was the only one at the table, and I hated this. The only one at that table that had to get up, go outside and be bonded to that damn cigarette, man, and sit there and smoke that thing all by myself outside the restaurant while everybody's laughing and joking inside and visiting with each other and stuff like that. I had to put the cigarette out, walk back in, stinking of nicotine, and sit down and, you know, and then rejoin them again. But I was in that bondage, and I hated that bondage that I was in. I began to recognize how much a slave I had become to nicotine, and I just couldn't stand it anymore. There was times when, you know, and I'm sure that everybody's gone through this, when I wouldn't have money for cigarettes, and I'm out of cigarettes, and I need cigarettes. Here I go walking down the street looking for butts in the gutter, and I would find one. I don't even know where it was been. Into my mouth it would go. I would light it up. I'd get it. And then I take another puff after all that, and another one, and another one. It was the most, and I hated it. I hated it. But I had to have my cigarettes at any cost because I was just scared to death of the withdrawal symptoms. And I just couldn't imagine a life without cigarettes at this time. I was so addicted. In my mind, I was just going to smoke for the rest of my life. I told myself, you know what? This may be my death. I don't know. I'm just going to smoke and smoke and smoke. I don't think I can quit. And I kept going. There was one time, about 1995, and I forget why I did, but I decided to quit. And I made it 30 days. Now, I'm the type of addict where I'll tell myself, out of a 365-day period, the most enjoyable cigarette that I could have out of a 365-day is the one after Thanksgiving dinner. I love that one. Oh, man, can't get by that one, man. After Thanksgiving, the most enjoyable cigarette. Fire up that cigarette after eating a big Thanksgiving dinner and all this food. And, oh, man, the cigarette. Oh, you're not just going to like this one. You're going to love this cigarette. This one's going to be the cigarette of the year, man. I made it about 30 days in the month of November, and then came Thanksgiving, and everybody went out. There were some smokers there that had Thanksgiving dinner with us, and they went out to smoke, and I had about 30 damn days, and I threw it all away. I said, no, I can't. I just lied to myself. That was addictive nature in my mind, that junky thinking that we have in our mind, that I just couldn't get by, and said, no, Dan, make it. This is the most enjoyable cigarette of the year. Go out and smoke one. And I went out and I fired one up, and immediately I went back to pack-a-day smoking. It was like I never quit, you know. And I got a little bit dizzy, you know, a little bit nauseous, and I had to get my body reused to the nicotine in my body again. But I did it, and it only took about 3 cigarettes, and I was off and running. And I just started smoking again and again and again. And I kept smoking all through the 90s. I got married. I had a son. Kept smoking. Didn't care about that. And I kept smoking. And about the year 2000, 20 years after my mother had quit smoking cigarettes, she was 80 years old. She was having trouble breathing, and she went to the doctor. And the doctor did some tests and said, guess what? You know, you smoked for a long time, didn't you? And she said, yeah. And he said, well, let's do some damage. Now she's developing emphysema due to the 40 years of smoking that she did before. And that was in the year 2000. I watched her as I'm still smoking. She started telling me, you know, Danny, don't smoke with what I'm going through. I got, you know, she had to get the oxygen tank, the inhalers, the medication, all this stuff all over the house. I just watched her go through that with the emphysema. Finally, it got so bad that on April 24th, she finally passed away from it. And we had to put her, you know, we forced the funeral and everything. At her funeral, a friend of hers came out, an old-time family friend from Arizona came out, still smoking. This woman also had stage 2 or stage 3 emphysema. I think it was stage 2 emphysema. Anyway, she had an oxygen tank at my mom's funeral. She would chain smoke 2 cigarettes in between oxygen treatments. And I looked at that and I thought, oh my God, I just saw my mother die this hellish death in the hospital from emphysema. I heard what I call the cough from hell come out of my mother's lungs, and at the age of 86 she was, it was just like, oh my God, the pain that she must have went through. Now I'm looking at this woman chain smoke, two cigarettes, in between oxygen treatments with stage 2 emphysema. This was a huge sign for me, like God was looking down on me and smacking me upside the head saying, hey fool, you think you can get past this, you're not. And it scared the crap out of me when I saw this woman chain smoke two cigarettes in between oxygen treatments. It really woke me up, and it scared me to death because I thought, okay, this is my future. I'm looking at my future. And it was probably out of fear that I made a decision and I took that third step and put it into action. And I said, well, I'm going to quit. I'm going to do it. Now, I don't know. I was told a story about a wheelbarrow, and I really don't have time to go over it. Maybe some of you have heard the wheelbarrow story. If you're a newcomer and you haven't heard the wheelbarrow story, ask an old-timer in any 12-step program what the wheelbarrow story is. They'll be glad to tell you what it is. It's the difference between having faith in a higher power and actually trusting in a higher power. And when you trust in that higher power, you're going to quit. You're going to go through it. Come hell or high water, no matter what, you're going to be willing to go through any lengths at all to make it. And on April 30th, 2004, at about 11:55, I took my last puff that I ever had in my life off the cigarette, and I put it out, and it was my last cigarette, and I wrinkled up the pack, and I threw in the trash can, and I did not ask God, I told the God of my understanding, I says, you're going to get me through this, whether you like it or not, you have no choice. I just quit. Cigarettes are going in your pocket, and you're the one with the problem now, not me. And you're going to get me through this whether you like it or not. That was it. I went to bed. I didn't know what the hell I was doing, people. The next day I woke up in the morning, about 8 o'clock in the morning. It had been eight hours, and you know how we all have to have that first cigarette of the morning. And I was like, oh my God, I quit. And I died for a cigarette. At that point, I began to go into shock. And I could not live my life one day at a time. People say, live your life one day. I couldn't do that because I'm so addicted to nicotine that 24 hours was too much. I couldn't make it. It's too much. You're asking too much. A whole day? I am not going to make it the whole day. I had to live for 1 week, my first week of my quit. I had to live my life 1 hour at a time. That's all I could do. It was the best I could do. I knew that I could go about 2 hours without a cigarette before I'd really start jonesing for one and really start climbing the walls. So someone suggested, can you make it 1 hour? I'll make it 1 hour. I can do it 1 hour. And every hour would come around, I would make a decision 1 hour at a time. Okay, it's 8 o'clock now. I'll go down to the store, I'll buy a pack of cigarettes at 9 o'clock, but slam my fist down on the table, rock solid promise to myself, I am not going to smoke for 1 hour, come hell or high water, and that's it. And I did it. And then 9 o'clock would come around, I would have to think, you have to make another decision. Well, am I going to do it? Well, I made it 1 hour. I guess I can make it just one more hour. What the hell? I'll go till 10 o'clock. Okay, 10 o'clock, I'm going to go down and get my cigarettes, but I am not going to smoke till 10 o'clock this morning, coming out of high water. I lived that way 1 hour at a time for an entire first 7 days of my quit, and my life became really surreal. I'll never forget that first week. I had to put myself through the most hellish experience of my life, and I'm glad that I did it because as I look back, I can remember that. I don't ever want to go through that again. It wasn't easy for me to quit. I had to pay a heavy price for it. And I don't ever want to go through that again. So that first day, I remember I had to keep my hands busy. And, while I'm craving the cigarette, I got online, and there was a group called, maybe some of you are familiar with it, it's called QuitNet. And I got involved with QuitNet. I should have got involved with Nicotine Online Recovery, though, but I wasn't too familiar. I didn't know that they had the voices and all that stuff right then, and I didn't really get too involved with it. Instead, I joined up with QuickNet. What I did was I got on the Yahoo search engine, and I typed in smoking cessation or something like that, or I quit smoking or something. They came back with a plethora of links. One of the links was this online thing, QuickNet. And I got involved with QuickNet, and it's not really a 12-step program, but it is an online support program for other people that quit smoking cigarettes. And I made a lot of friends through QuickNet, and I stayed with QuickNet through about my first year. I also studied the effects of nicotine, how it runs through your body. I learned what dopamine is, and I never knew that. And it's like a paintbrush. If you've ever seen a worn-out paintbrush after years and years, how frazzled it gets, that's what your nerve endings look like. And that without the nicotine, they'll start to get really irritated, and that's what makes you want a cigarette. You'll get really grouchy and grumpy. You want to fight and kill everybody, launch nuclear warheads. What that does is that the nicotine will soothe that feeling down when you smoke. And you have to do it again and again and again and again and again, over and over and over, to keep those nerve endings from smoothing down. Well, now, you know, I'm freaking out here. I don't have any nicotine going through my nerve endings. And I'm kind of like, I don't know if you've ever seen a movie called The Good Man Charlie Brown, put out by Charles Schulz. It came out in the 1970s. But that's, you know, it was a Peanuts cartoon. It was actually a movie back in the early 70s called You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. And I can remember in that part of the movie, Linus, if you remember Linus with his blanket. Well, in this movie, Linus lost his blanket somehow. And damn, he needed that blanket. Linus went through the most hellish withdrawal symptoms. The longer the way that he was away from his blanket, he was like, dragging himself across the desert floor. I identify so much with Linus and his blanket. That's how I was without my cigarettes, you know? I was dragging myself across the desert floor. That first week was so hellish. What I did also to keep myself, my hands busy and stuff like that, which worked good, was, I don't know if you remember a show called Kojak with Telly Savalas. Well, Telly Savalas, as I understand, he actually quit cigarettes in real life, and he used Tootsie Pops, the hand in the mouth. And he had it in his contract when he did that show, Kojak, that he's going to suck on these Tootsie Pops to keep himself from smoking cigarettes. He was willing to go to any length. And they said, okay, then we'll have this tough cop eating Tootsie Pops in the show, you know, but he said, I gotta do this. So they let him do it, you know. And I can remember as a teenager, even in my early stages of smoking, I thought, that's a hell of a good idea. If I ever decide to quit, I'm gonna try that, because it's the hand in the mouth. That worked real bad, just clicked with me. So I went out and I got Tootsie Pops in my first week, and I'm eating these Tootsie Pops and lollipops and sunflower seeds, and I'm doing the hand in the mouth. And at work, I was so addicted that, you know, I went through, when it came time for a break, there was a group of us that would go out to the smoking area at work, and we'd all sit around and light up our cigarettes and stuff like that. I was so addicted to that behavior that at work on my first week, when it came time to break, I walked out to the smoking area, sat down, everybody else whipped out cigarettes, lit them up. I flip out a Tootsie Pop out of an empty Marlboro pack, people. Take the wrapper off, stick it in my mouth. I had a lighter in my pocket. I took the lighter out, and I flicked the lighter, and I put the flame to the end of the Tootsie Pop, and I took the Tootsie Pop, and I went, just like a cigarette. Held it like a cigarette and everything. And my friends are looking at me like, man, are you flicked out? Do you know you just lit up a Tootsie Pop? And I said, yes, I know, I'm trying to quit. I'm willing to go to any length. I'm just really addicted to this type of behavior. And I just got to do. And I did that every break for my first week. And then these people were like, man, you're weird, Dan. And I didn't care what they thought. I was willing to go to any length to stay quit. But I couldn't take away from that behavior over, you know, going out to the smoking area, sitting down and going through the motions of, you know, it was just that addictive for me. And it took me about a week before I finally weaned myself off from doing that. That was my just the addictive compulsive behavior that I had in me. But I was willing to go through any lengths to get out of that. About my third month of my quit, 90 days, studied up for this. I know that there's some people went through this, some people don't go through it. It depends on how our body reacts to withdrawal. But about my third month, some of us go through what is known as, how do I explain this? Okay, your mind and your nervous system, they kind of get together and they're like, and your emotions too, your emotions, your physical, the mental and the emotions all get together and they're like, hey, you know what, man? Damn serious about quitting. It's about 90 days. What the hell are we doing here, man? We got to get this guy smoking. And it's like this last gasp that your body is screaming out for nicotine. And I went through this phase of depression. Now, I don't know if anybody else has gone through this, but I would be at work, and all of a sudden, this deep feeling of sadness would engulf me, and I wouldn't have no reason to be sad. I had a job. My health was decent. I had a roof over my head. My son was doing okay. There was food in the fridge. Life isn't really that bad, but yet I felt miserable. And I would have to walk away from my workstation, and I'd have to lock myself in the bathroom, sit down on the toilet, and for about 10 minutes, I cried. I'm thinking, why in the hell is the matter with me? Why do I have to do this? Why am I crying? Why do I feel so sad? And I studied up on it, and I found out that this is a period in our quits, about 90 days or so. Some of us go through this to where we just get depressed for no reason, and a lot of people will relapse during this time. I didn't do it, thank God. I just went in and lasted about 5 days where I would just go in and I would cry for about 10 minutes. And then that phase got through, and I'm glad I made it through that phase because I could have relapsed real easy. In July, I got a ticket. I was on vacation driving through Arkansas on my way to Memphis. And I had gotten a ticket in some cop pulled me over. This was about, let me see, May, June, about, 60 days or so. Anyways, that was a breaking point. They had me pay this fine, and they were going to put me in jail, and all this crap. I hated it to the max. I walked out of that jail after paying that fine, and I told my wife still smokes today. I'm living with a nicotine addict that's still actively using, yes. Anyways, I told my wife, give me a cigarette, and I was going to smoke. I was going to throw it all away. I was just right down there on my knees. I was so frazzled about that, and she wouldn't do it. I thank God for that. She said, no, Danny, you know, you've got 2 months now. Why do you do it? She talked me through it, and she talked me into steps. But the point is that in my mind, my addicted, that old junkie, jumped up there and started screaming at me. I had no defense on my power. I was powerless. I was going to smoke, I am telling you. And if she wouldn't have talked me through that, I wouldn't have made it. I would have been smoking today. That's how powerfully addictive nicotine can get to us. About my 10th month of my quit, I was investigated at work. I work with kids in a foster care facility, and these kids are wards in the state of California, okay? They belong to the state of California. They've been taken away from their parents, they've been abused by their parents, and placed in this foster care facility. My job was I worked in the kitchen, I served them their food. Well, for some reason or another, whatever reason, I don't know, someone went around spreading the rumor that I was selling drugs to these kids. And that to me is pure stupidity. I mean, you could get arrested and thrown in prison immediately if you're selling drugs to kids in the wards of the state, let alone just kids off the street under the age of 18. That's bad enough. But if you're selling to the wards of the state, you're really going to get busted. They're really going to press charges against you. And in my opinion, you'd have to be a complete idiot. Yes, I can hear you. Rossi? Can everybody still hear me? Okay, all right, I'm sorry. I'm reading here. Anyways, I was investigated. I still got about 5 minutes. Don't worry, I'll wrap it up here in a minute. I was investigated for selling drugs to these kids, and I was so angered at this. I was so insulted and so hurt. I felt like they were calling me an idiot, my co-workers and my employers and stuff. And one day I was driving home. I caught myself in front of 7-Eleven. I was so upset, so frazzled over this. My emotions, my anger, everything was coming out like a volcano on me. I couldn't believe it. I caught myself in front of 7-Eleven counting out cigarette money. And I decided, you know, I'm going to throw this away. This is at 10 months, people. 10 months. I was on my knees again. I started really thinking, as I'm sitting there in front of 7-Eleven counting out the money, I started thinking about the 12-step program and everything that I've been through. And I decided, you know, that I was going to pray and meditate. And luckily, my higher power told me to cry. You know, I have to cry through this. And that was a good thing. I sat in that parking lot, and instead of going in and hiding and doing up my covering the emotional crap that I was going through, I decided to cry, and I just cried it all out right there in the parking lot for about 10 minutes, and I released all that pent-up emotional frustration that I was going through, and that got me through that thing. But, you know, I was down on my knees at that point. After 10 months, I was going to smoke again, and these are reminders to me of how powerfully addictive nicotine is. It's probably the most addictive substance I have ever put into my body in my entire life. I'm probably more addicted to nicotine than any other thing in my life. Now, last May 9th, I'm almost done here, just bear with me. Last May 9th, I've worked at a job for 3 years, and at one point I wasn't really getting along with my boss, and she was going to try to get me fired, or she wasn't going to try to get me fired, she was going to try to make me quit, so she started to treat me like crap, and I figured, no way, you're not going to do it. And I brown-nosed her, and I brown-nosed the company that I worked for, and I just kissed butt, and I took a lot of crap from these people, and went through a lot of hell to keep my job. I showed up every day, I was never late, and I did my job, and I never talked back to the boss, and I put up with a lot of crap that people were doing. Well, anyway, it was last May night, lo and behold, vice president of the company walks in, calls me to the office, and says, Dan, guess what? You're out. And I was like shocked, and I'm like, but why? What did I do? And they didn't give me an excuse. They just, Dan, you're gone. You're out. Go. You're fired. You know, and they handed me a couple checks, severance pay, my final paycheck, and it added up to close to about $1,000, and I was in shock. I was very hurt. My low self-esteem started flowing again. I was angry. Again, these freaking damn emotions. Damn, you've got $1,000 cash with you. Why don't you go out and hit up a bar? Let's cash these checks. Go to a bar, buy an ounce of pot, get an 8-ball of Coke and a carton of cigarettes, and just let it go, man. Let's all go to hell. Let's get arrested, man. The hell with it, man. We're just going to let it all go, man. That was the old junkie thinking of me. Well, I didn't do that. I just knew instinctively. I thought, no, that isn't answer anymore for me. That ain't going to happen. So I dismissed that thought. I went home and I called my sponsor and I told him what had happened. And my sponsor pointed out to me immediately, I didn't even know what was going on. He said, see, there's your recovery. God's doing for you what you can't do for yourself. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, you intuitively knew how to handle a situation which used to baffle you. But one time, it would have been a perfect excuse for me to go out and go to a bar and buy all these drugs and cigarettes and just really tie one on and probably end up in jail. This today, I knew it, and I dismissed it immediately, and instead I went and called my sponsor, and he pointed out to me, he said, Dan, see, there's recovery right there. There's part of your reward. The problems are starting to work in your life now, aren't you? And that made me really grateful, and I'll never forget that, you know? Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, and I know I'm another 12-step program, and for the purposes of, for the singleness of purpose, because I apologize for that, but, you know, we can't get away from Bill W. He's the one that started it all, and that big book is just pure freaking genius, man. There is so much wisdom in that. We all have to turn back to that, because that's where it all started. But, yeah, it's today, my life is not peaches and cream or anything like that, but I am very grateful for the little things that I did get in this program, and the little things add up to the big things. One of the big things is, number one, for me, Dan, the addict that smoked a pack today, and I know I'm not the most addicted person in the world, there's more people that are more addicted to me. Today I have freedom from the bondage of smoking. And today I meditate on that every day. Today I don't have to worry about where my next cigarette's going to come from, or if I have the money from it, or if I have to walk into a room stinking and conscious of it, or whether I'm going to start a fire from it, or how much money is going to be lost on it, or how it's affecting my health, or how the secondhand smoke can be affecting my family, or blah, 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 on and on and on and on. Today I'm free from that. And I am so grateful to my higher power for that. I got these things through practicing the 12-step program. And it's just the basic tools that this program has handed me. Going to meetings, sharing, calling my sponsor, reading the literature, praying, meditating, you know, just those basic tools right there on a daily basis help me get on through another 24-hour period. If you're new in this program, like, I forgot your name. Kenny, I guess your name is. You've got 12 hours. I don't know if you have ever done this before, but, you know, and if you're going to quit, like, there's a few people that are going to quit on Monday. One thing that you have to tell yourself is, at 5 years, months, okay, then you're familiar with it. The one thing you have to be prepared for is that you're going to pay a price for your addiction. You're going to go through that withdrawal stage, you know. But one thing that, I'm not the answer man or anything, but if I'm going to suggest any advice at all for people to try to help you, just do your best to not only have faith in a power greater than yourself, but for crying out loud, trust in that higher power. And when you can trust in that higher power, boom, you go, you quit. And you just go through whatever it is you gotta go through to stay quit. Because quitting is easy, but staying quit is really hard. And there's days today in my recovery, you know, I used to hear an old timer go around AA, years ago when I was first quitting my drinking and stuff like that. An old timer used to go around the AA meetings and they would say, "It doesn't matter, just don't drink. It don't matter, just don't drink." And I would say, "It does matter. Don't you see? I'm in my first 30 days. It does matter. It does." I didn't understand what that old timer was trying to tell me. But today I understand what that means. And what it means is that, you know, I pray, that doesn't do no good. I try to meditate, no, I still want to smoke. I call my sponsor, damn it, I still want to smoke. I go to a meeting and my mind is shut, damn it, I still want to smoke. But everything that I have to work for in this program goes out the window. If I smoke a cigarette, not 90% of it's gone, not 99% of it's gone, 100% of everything that I have worked for in my quit, spiritually and everything else, is gone. It is gone, erased. I have just thrown everything away, and I will never get it back. I have to start all over again and quit from scratch again. And today, I always remember that. There's times in my recovery when nothing seems to work, and I just want to smoke, I want to smoke, I want to smoke, I want to smoke, I want to have a cigarette, I want to have a cigarette. Even, I'm going on 14 months now, I've got 13 and a half months smoke-free, I still get those cravings, and that junkie is still there with me, and I'm so glad because it humbles me to remember that I am human, and that it's okay, and it doesn't happen all the time, you know. Most of the time, I'm grateful for my recovery that I can go through, but every once in a while, I'm dropped to my knees, and that nicotine comes through and just says, you know what, you're a human being, man. Don't forget that you are an addict. You are powerless, and your life is unmanageable, damn it. And when those times come, I always remember that old timer going around saying, it don't matter, just don't drink. Because I always tell myself, it don't matter, just don't smoke. I will not smoke if my ass falls off. No way. Not today. Not this 24-hour period. I don't care how great this craving is. I remember the serenity prayer for smokers, which makes a tremendous amount of sense. And I'm looking and I'm saying, you know what? It's just a freaking craving. It'll go in 7 minutes. It's just one of those things. So what? I recognize it. Yeah. Let's go and get it over with, whatever. But I don't smoke, and I haven't smoked for the last 13 and a half months by the grace of God and the tools of this program. I'm very grateful for everyone being here. You guys, thank you very much for sticking with me. This room had 19 people when it started. It looks like it still has 19 people. I hope I haven't bored too many of you. you know, it's this kind of support. I'm going to shut up in a minute now. But it's this kind of support that helps me stay quit. Me, I'm not trying to be, you know, a poster child or get famous or anything like that. I'm just little old, off and on, Nicotine Online Anonymous, Voices of Nicotine Recovery. That's all I am. But it's this type of thing, when I hear these words come out of my mouth and I confess it, not only do I hear my own self say, but I confess it to other people, that gives me strength to stay quit for 24 more hours. And I am so grateful for that. And I just hope that the newcomers, you know, I hope that I have shared a message. If I can help one person, just one person, I told them one little equally thing, it makes it all worth it for me. That gives me the strength to go on and stay 24 more hours and just to keep going day by day by day. And I love you all. It's time for me to shut up now. I thank you so much for listening to me. It has done me so much. Good. I'm glad you didn't smoke during the meeting. It has been tremendous help for me to be speaker of this meeting. I'm going to shut up now. I love you all, and I thank you, and keep coming back.